Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of Freaky Trigger and the Pollards of Lop, our monthly audio entertainment based on the Twitter polls that I'm running at the @people_pop account. This month's poll has been about debut singles, and as of recording, it's just reaching its final week, with acts like Britney Spears, Nana Cherry and Art Brut fighting it out for the imaginary trophy. Here to talk about debut singles with me are Kat.
Hello.
Kerry.
Hello.
And Pete.
Hello.
So let's start by asking the question the poll has been trying to figure out. What makes a good debut single?
To my mind, the most important thing about a debut single is that it should make some money, which means that the artist then can make more music, unless, of course, it's bad, in which case it should not make money so that the artist can stop making music.
There have been a few singles that we've discussed which are the only recordings, even though, as in the case of Pump Up the Volume by Mars, it made a great deal of money.
There is a thing with debut singles where, you know, you are setting out your stall, but have you built your stall yet? Do you know what your stall is? Or, I mean, there are bands, I mean, we've talked about them in the past here, like Blur, which take like 2 or 3 albums, or at least 2 albums, to get into the thing they end up doing, but at the beginning were just rampant sort of pastiche artists almost of a scene.
Yeah.
Or you could be like Steps, where you're just cashing in on a current trend of line dancing and it happens to be a mega smash, and then the rest of your career doesn't really fit with what you did in your debut at all.
No, it does sort of stand out a bit on the Steps Greatest Hits CD, which I'm sure we're all familiar with.
It's certainly the most boshing of their singles.
Yeah, maybe that's what'll happen to Lil Nas X, that after his initial country-based thing, he will get into ABBA pastiches.
I was always a bit worried about Steps' debut, because Lee does the rapping on it and H doesn't actually do anything at all. And the girls are just, you know, doing the chorus and dancing, but Lee's kind of almost Ray from 2 Unlimited rapping vibes on it. I'm really glad they didn't continue with that. So it's kind of a relief, really.
Yeah, they had to give him something to do, I guess, down the line, though there are many bands that have carried dead weights for quite some time. So.
I mean, in terms of like what makes a good debut single, I think rather than sort of the, you know, if you're going to introduce yourself, you actually should introduce yourself. You should name the band members, if there are many of you, or if there is just you yourself. Say your name over and over and over again. Like, I've got loads on here. Like Craig David, for example, in his Rewind, When the Crowds Say Bo Selector, which, although it's technically an Artful Dodger single, it was on Craig David's album, so it does count. He actually says Craig David every single time in the chorus, and it sticks in your mind. You know, it's what I would do. Same with like Snoop Dogg. What's my name? It's Snoop Dogg.
Yes.
Look, every single time.
It doesn't always work though, because obviously Living in a Box is a debut single. Living in a Box from their debut album, Living in a Box, goes, I'm living in a box, I'm living in a cardboard box, about 20 times in the song, but they never really had another hit. So maybe they overdid it.
It's not very aspirational, is it? The living in a cardboard box.
No, it's not. It's what traps them, perhaps, into people thinking they were box bait artists or, you know, living in box, you know, an issues band. But they weren't really an issues band, unless that issue was living in a box, living in a cardboard box.
The originator of this, of course, was Bo Diddley, who's excellent. Bo Diddley. Was in the poll, and it is all about the adventures of Bo Diddley, and then in fact all his other singles, or nearly all his other singles, also had the words Bo Diddley in the title.
I mean, it helps that Bo Diddley scans very well and is really easy to make fit lots of different sort of rhythms and meters and lyrical patterns.
It's interesting you talked about Bo Diddley there. I mean, we look at going back much further. What a debut single does now or did in the 90s or 70s or 50s is very different. I mean, in the 50s, debut singles pretty much were kind of accidental. They were just the first thing you recorded. You were out there as a jobbing musician, and it was the next stage was maybe to record something. So you might have had quite a large amount of material already, but it also might not be your best.
I think one of the, like, when we were researching good debuts, someone said, oh, Tutti Frutti by Little Richard. And I looked into it and it turned out that actually Little Richard had recorded loads of stuff before Tutti Frutti. So there was this, you know, not only is there a lot of material, probably you'd recorded some of it anyway. And so it took a certain amount of kind of, it takes a certain amount of like after the fact sort of massaging of the legend to kind of big up some of those early debuts into something more important than perhaps they actually were.
Well, there are in some cases where the idea of a debut single is incidental to the body of work. The, you know, one of the two singles that I put out was the sort of slightly like trolling wax cylinder accordion recording. But the purpose of that release was not to say, oh, like, look at this accordion player who we are launching onto the sort of music stage. It was to say, oh, you know, this accordion player who you will have heard in music halls and this tune that you will be familiar with from song sheets that you might have played at home. Here is a nice recording of this so that you can listen to it if you'd like to. But it wasn't in any way a launch or something new. It was capturing something that was already in existence and a style and a tune that people would already have been...
Yeah.
Very sort of intimately familiar with.
I mean, also my understanding of the very early days of recorded sound and that is a lot of it was kind of like, well, I bet they can't get an accordion right. And it's like, aha, you know, in our next installment of the Edison Wax Cylinder Club, we will, in fact, record an accordion with perfect fidelity.
Yes, yes. It was about the technical accomplishments. Yes, yes. And I think, and sometimes also sort of capturing specific performers. So there was that aspect of a star or sort of a music artist. But again, those would have been artists who would have been already known from playing music halls or from playing sort of tours, that it wasn't introducing, you know, the debut single wouldn't have been the introduction to them. They would already have been famous, and the recording would have been almost like a memento, like sort of the equivalent of like a concert t-shirt instead of the only way that you would have to access them or the introduction to them.
That's kind of like X Factor, really. You've been following them already, and like getting the single for your nan for Christmas is just kind of what you do at the end.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's the thing, it's what she understands as music as well. It's like the end point of winning a recording. What you win is a recording contract, so you have to produce a recording, which in kind of the Western music business is still a single followed by an album. And I think this kind of comes into that idea as well of what are singles for. So singles up until about 10 years ago at least, for the last 40 years or so, singles are often your lead single off an album, and then further singles of an album. They were hype bits for the album sometimes, or they existed in their own fact. So a debut single may exist way before the album is a twinkling in anyone's eyes. It's a proof of concept in some ways. You get the single right, we'll let you make the album.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot cheaper to do a single. Like for someone who's put out records, it's not the most like inexpensive pastime recording music in a studio. If you can get a label, convince a label to stump up the cash for you, that is a bonus. But self-funding it is definitely, yeah, you've got to really want to, you know, do it for the love, I think, or have a really, really, really good song. Like if you're a Prince and you have got the perfect demo tape and you're just like, look, you don't even need a fancy studio. Look, I've already done it. Here you go. Release this. Make me a megastar, please. Then that's fine. But we're not all Prince, unfortunately.
But like, Kat, when you put out a debut,
back in the mists of time when dinosaurs ruled the earth, yes.
Yeah, but like, was there like debut single nerves? Was it like, we've got to get the right song, we've got to, you know,
it's almost about desperately trying to record something and not sound crap, number one, because we had such limited time to do the recording and not very many takes to do it. And also this is back where there was a label just paying for a single. And we had to go with the songs that they liked, not the songs that we liked.
Right.
And we I hated the single. It was my least favourite of all of the songs we played in that band, just because I couldn't play it very well. And it was really stressful trying to play it over and over again and getting it wrong every time. And by the time we finished it and recorded it, I was like sick to death of it completely. And then you had to wait for ages for it to sort of get mastered and pressed and everything. And by that time, your record label has gone bust because Pete Doherty has spent all the proceeds on crack.
Because obviously, from the consumer point of view, you know, indie debuts particularly are presented as this great statement. It's like, here is a band, you know, making its entry into the world and with a kind of thunderbolt of meaningful things. And actually, probably what was happening behind the scenes was something very like what you've described, Kat, of, you know, like lots of compromises, lots of like bullshit and waiting around and getting sick of the music and Pete Doherty.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's almost like, we've written so many good songs since we did that, and this doesn't represent us at all. And I think like some of the songs in the poll, you can kind of see that it's either not the right time for the band, and you know, either not quite ready yet, or that they are ready yet, but that song doesn't represent where they are now.
Yeah, I think the point about something, a debut single being representative of what the rest, either the rest of the album is or the rest of the recording artist's work is going to be, is a really interesting one. Bruce Springsteen's debut single, which I, although I am a Bruce fan, don't necessarily think is the best in that way, was written after most of his debut album because the studio executive thought that it needed something that could stand on its own. In my mind, it's not very representative of the rest of his work, and it's not, it wasn't very successful at the time, and it wasn't successful in the poll, which I think, Kat, goes back to your
it's not even the best version of that song, is it?
It's not even the best version of that song, exactly. it's about sort of what the sort of studio thinks is going to be most successful, which might not be what the artist's vision is coming from, or sort of why they decided to make music in the first place. And that there's that mismatch about what's chosen by someone who is not the artist to be the quote unquote big capital letters debut single, which might be either misleading or just a bit crap.
Just to say that the song we're talking about is Blinded by the Light, in case anyone doesn't know, and Man from Man did the better version, I think.
You do get a lot of rhymes for your money. You get your money's worth in Blinded by the Light. You get a great deal of rhymes.
Oh, yeah.
If rhymes are what you're
sure
looking
do.
For.
You sure do, and actually, it was written by Bruce going through a rhyming dictionary looking for rhymes, which he then back wrote the lyrics to.
Who could have guessed?
So presumably that was the note that the studio gave him. They said, Bruce, we love the work, but more rhymes. More. The people demand rhymes.
Speaking of sax.
Yes.
Speaking of soulful sax playing, Careless Whisper, it turns out, is another example, which is still in the poll. At the moment.
Controversial,
yes. Is it a debut? We'll get on at some point, I think, in this podcast to the many debuts of George Michael. But this one in particular, he didn't like. Is something that I discovered. So that's another example of a debut single that the artist wasn't actually terribly happy, if it was a debut single, which the artist wasn't actually terribly happy about. And in fact, he was very angry in interviews. He said it really disillusioned him about the music business, that something so obviously bad could make him a huge amount of money and become incredibly successful in the signature song.
Oh no, poor George.
Yeah, poor George. Well, he shouldn't have put such a great sax riff on it.
Yeah, and certainly you could tell how unhappy he was when he promoted it during its period at number one on Top of the Pops. You could tell from his demeanour that he wasn't behind this decision.
Was he frowning?
No, he couldn't have. Well, it's a sad song, you know.
Like embodying the guilt of like his feet having no rhythm and feeling sad about it.
It's possible. So in the States it was released as Wham. Is that right? Or was it just
Wham
on the album?
Featuring George Michael?
Right, as opposed to normal Wham that doesn't feature George Michael is mainly Andrew Ridgeley Heavy.
Well, I thought I saw a comment on Twitter replying to the poll saying that it wasn't purposely released as a Wham song because it didn't fit with the upbeat mood of Wham, and it was too miserable.
that was George's latter day excuse for why it wasn't released as a Wham song.
And where does Where does Different Corner fit in on this as well?
Well, Different Corner was credited to George Michael Everywhere, but it was also on a Wham album.
Yeah.
So
it's pre him officially going solo, isn't it?
So yeah. So for a post Wham recording, you have to go to I Knew You Were Waiting For Me.
But that is the best song ever.
But that is not a solo George Michael. It's George and. It's not a feat.
That's George and Aretha. So like it's Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that duet, actually. You know, duets being a debut, if the two members of the duet were already famous. Mm. I think Marvin and Tammy, while that was obviously a good song, that should not have been in the poll.
Question for you, Kat. Would your opinion on that be different if they had a band name? So if instead of Marvin and Tammy, if they had been named something like the bottle of wine that's in front of me right now, because that's what's in front of me and I can't think of anything else, would that have... It would be, but, you know, with
the art, you can squeeze it in.
To your question, I think yes, because it's not relying on the weight of their names to carry it. So if you were in a supergroup, you have to either like know a little bit about the supergroup first, which by which time you probably already heard the song, maybe, or that you're interested in the song, fine. But you know that it's going to be something new. It's not just them doing their own thing. It's either going to be some greater than their parts or a completely new direction. Who knows?
Mm. And I suppose renaming it also suggests the intention to create something new, as in it's not existing person plus existing person.
I think so. I think it has to be going in like different directions. So,
I think, I mean, the one I brought up, because it was they were head to head. It was Marvin and Tammy against Electronic. Now, Electronic, obviously, particularly that debut single is
Barney Sumner and Johnny Marr.
Barney Sumner and Johnny Marr, but you've also got Pet Shop Boys as well. Yeah, Neil Tennant hanging around in there as well. But and the song's also called Getting Away With It. So in as much as from the poll perspective, yeah, they got away with it, though didn't get as far.
No. They got hammered by Marvin and Tammy, so they didn't, in fact, get away with it in this. But
I think there's what Kat's saying about, like, when you listen to it, you can probably... It doesn't take a genius to work out the constituent parts of that one. Whereas with Marvin and Tammy...
I think the thing with Marvin and Tammy, though, is that it sort of became a debut in retrospect because it was very successful and they did loads more together and they became a recognised duet outfit in a way that...
So would you have led it in the poll if that had not happened, if that had been their only...
Yeah, I don't think I would have, because, I mean, there's many reasons why I wouldn't have let Morrissey and Susie's interlude, in the poll. But because that was their only one, it doesn't really... A sole duet doesn't for me cut it, but yeah, I let Marvin and Tammy, also because it was a good song, and at the time we had very few old songs, so it was like, yeah, let them off in a way that I would perhaps have frowned on, you know, one of those many duets that cropped up in the 90s where Tom York and someone out of Salad or whoever did stuff together.
Frank Sinatra and Jimmy Buffett.
Always a great one.
Frank was in anyway. Whether I ever found the right recording of Night and Day, of the millions he did.
I don't think there is a right recording for Frank's Night and Day. I'm sorry, Frank. I rate you, but Cole Porter is not.
But that's an example of a solo debut, where obviously Frank Sinatra was very famous before, but he was famous as featuring the 30s equivalent of the Artful Dodger featuring Craig David. Was things like
Well, and as a nightclub singer, I mean, he was famous as an in-person performer who people would travel to see. Something I was thinking about earlier this evening was how there aren't any that I'm aware of recordings of musical numbers, as in from a stage musical, in the debut singles poll, and kind of where the line is between somebody who is mainly a live performer, like Frassini, the accordion player, like Frank Sinatra when that was recorded, like Bo Diddley, and kind of where... Because I think that a cast soundtrack would, to my mind, not qualify in any way for this debut singles sort of idea. But what's the difference between a live musical, which is something that is sort of known and which people go to travel to see live, and those musical artists where that's how they were mostly
known. I think there are definitely artists who were mostly known for musicals who I would have said, yeah, okay, if someone had put in, you know, Elaine Page's debut single, I don't know if it was from a musical or not, or Julie Covington or one of the other kind of people who used to have regular hits with Lloyd Webber songs in the 70s, and then kind of, then that would have been absolutely fine. They put out singles and one of those singles was a debut. I think that a kind of whole cast recording would have been, yeah, it's hard to justify that one.
But I think also in that is, like, part of the question we're having about debut singles is it's as much about the artist as it is about the single. So, you know, as going back to, is it representative of the artist, but also if it breaks them, is it something that makes you think of that artist fondly? I mean, there are artists who haven't made any leeway in the poll at all because their debuts are a bit crap.
Catatonia, you know, good grief. Well, my, oh, like, I mean,
that was in the poll, but God, poor stinker.
It's not their best, is it? I mean,
I quite liked them back then, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't have a huge beef with Catatonia, but I was surprised at how poor that was. It felt very much like somebody was a big, rather than somebody thinking, I know who had a great debut, Catatonia. It was, I know who's great and needs to be in the poll, Catatonia. Let's put their debut in, no matter what it is.
Yeah, same with Pink Floyd. Like, I don't know why they bothered releasing that song at all. I mean, I'm not a huge Pink Floyd fan, but they have got some memorable tracks in their output. That one about a boring song about some dude is not, like, it's not, that's not it for me, I'm afraid.
I mean, there are bands, the prog bands who never recorded singles as well. So we had a bit of conversation before, and I don't think anyone in the end went for anything by Led Zepp because it was a bit complicated to work out, and in the States there are things which were sort of singles.
Yeah, well, because they were getting radio play in the States, and there was a couple of people were like, I can't believe that whatever the album track off Led Zepp 2 or something that became a single wasn't in the poll. And it's like, no, it wasn't here.
I was going to say with the prog track that I enjoyed most was the Amon Dul 2 track, which is, to me, that in my mind, that is what the Velvet Underground should sound like. Whereas the actual Velvet Underground has always been very disappointing for me when I've listened to them. Whereas this is just like some woman wailing along with a banging sort of proggy underneath, and it all feels like a lava lamp's going to tip over at any second. It's great. It's a big party. I love it.
I mean, it does bring up the whole sort of poll methodology issue where, I mean, Altamira's Party being a great example of, are people voting for this as a great song, as a great debut single, or because they love the Velvet Underground? And I think that we're always going to be in this sort of liminal zone of why are people voting for things, and the better known tracks are going to do better.
Yeah.
I think now in the last 32, there's very few unknowns left.
I think, Let's Eat Grandma. Now Let's Eat Grandma have been turfed out of the poll. The number of real unknowns. We never have unknowns in the.
But equally, some of the big beasts have gone out.
Yeah, some of the big beasts have gone out. Big Beatley beasts. But again, that's because the Beatles had a rubbish debut. I think, like, just going back to the Led Zepp thing, one of the things that I realised when I was putting it together is, there isn't much metal in the poll. And it then struck me when I actually looked into all the metal bands who I thought were famous enough to have singles that were in the poll, all of their actual debuts were things called, like, you know, Mean Bluesy Woman, that had kind of come out. And then, like, invariably it was their second or third track that was the famous one. So this, it seemed to me to be a genre where people just weren't, it's like, no, we don't care about, just, you know, knock out a single if someone's got the money, as sort of like Kat was saying beforehand. But you need that kind of ecosystem of hype around a genre for a debut to matter. And that's partly why we had so many indie bands in the past.
Yeah, I think with metal you're looking at, there's a solid gigging scene where, you know, they're cutting their chops. And actually, until someone has seen a band live a few times, they're not going to buy a record. Whereas in the 90s, if you got a feature piece in the NME, everyone was waiting for that toilet tour and then that first record, and you had literally one chance to kind of get it right. So, you know, Suede and the Blue Tones and all that kind of stuff throw out what ends up being one of their bigger songs straight away, hoping to get radio play on the back of hype.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about this because I didn't read much of the music press in the 90s, although I was listening to a lot of pop radio, and I would hear, like, you know, random debut songs, like Brand Van 3000, for example, like, popped up, never heard of them, I had no idea who they were, I liked the song, fine. Suede, like, pop up on the radio, I was like, I don't know who they are, but I maybe seen them mentioned on Teletext Planet Sound once or twice. They're like, sure. And I would mostly hear debuts on compilations as well. And that's when I'd find out it was their first single. So things like the Now compilations would be where I would find out about new artists.
Well, at that point, a debut single could quite easily chart with a bit of sort of Evening Session and NME hype. So as long as it's charting within the top 25 or so, it will make it onto a Now. And as you say, then that builds that bit around. And certainly there was that whole thing where here's a new band, they're touring. Go and see them on the tour. They've got a single coming out. We ecstatically review the single. Then they get their cover piece. Then they've got another single coming out. Then it's getting exciting. Then we're talking about an album. And then they have a really long song out where they rap on it. So it's, you know, that's the lifespan of a debut band, and then everyone's bored of them because they take 2 years off. And
about what time do we think that if there was a shift between here is this artist or here is this group who everyone has heard live and they are famous for being live, again, the, like, sort of Frank Sinatra as an example, now by the recording of this as a memento or as something to sort of keep from that, to, oh, here is the single, listen to this, and then when they come around to tour later, buy tickets. Was that something that was like linear, or?
I think it works very differently in different countries as well. So I think in the UK it works differently to the States, because obviously the States is so large to tour, and the different kind of radio genres and the interaction between black buyers and white buyers and all that kind of stuff. So I think TV is very important as well. So again, it's like if they've been on the Ed Sullivan Show or something like that in the States, that's the bit where you sell your record, the Billboard charts. So, you know, Casey Kasem will big it up and then it's there. But it was a lot. And pop radio is a very, very regimented thing in the States, or was a very regimented thing. In a way, in the UK, it wasn't quite the same.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up listening to, like, Capital FM, which, like, George Michael had a big share in. And so any of his new singles, we're getting off debuts a little bit here, but any of his new songs would instantly get, like, first play on there, and you'd hear all about it. And I think since people sort of maybe moved away from radio onto internet and things like that, obviously you're getting that sort of that teaser from a slightly different place. You might get your 30 seconds, and that's all you get to make that little impact now. Whereas previously, it'd still be 30 seconds back in the 90s, but it'd be because, like, the, you know, Chris Tarrant's talking over the top of it and you can't hear the rest.
I mean, there is that difference between a debut record and a one-hit wonder. And a lot of them, and most of the things we're talking about here are debuts, which then the bands had careers afterwards. I mean, the Mars one is a bit of an outlier on that front, but mainly these are established acts. These aren't one-hit wonders, and that's a different... People see that in a different way.
Is this where we talk about Babylon Zoo?
Yes.
So, like, Babylon Zoo, I found this, like, interesting because it was a song from a jeans advert. It was never meant to be a big, long career-launching campaign for Babylon Zoo, but they had a hit single from it, and the first 30 seconds of that single is possibly, you know, the most 90s piece of pop music ever, and obviously the rest is the greatest piece of art ever.
Also not on 90s, the rest of the Babylon Zoo single.
Indeed.
But a different way.
But it's kind of that, it was almost like it was never meant to happen. Like, the same with Girls Aloud on Popstars Arrivals. Like, they were never meant to have a career. They were meant to have a throwaway single that you buy for your nan at Christmas. And even then, it wasn't meant to be the good one. That's the, like, famous story. but it's almost like it wasn't worth spending money on this act. We're just going to go for the one single only. So we've got to put everything into it, kitchen sink.
Can I just break in and ask, what is it with jeans ads and debut singles, in that the ad that I would most associate with sort of notable music, launching the artist of someone, launching the career of an artist, is the Gap Jump, Jive and Wail ad, which sort of kicked off the swing craze in the 90s, which I think was the debut single of the Brian Setzer Orchestra. Did that make it to the UK at all?
No, not really. I mean, I was more aware of it, but the Brian Setzer Orchestra was there. They tried to make it, and when we looked askance at them with a jaundiced eye and went, "No, thank you, sir. We've got our Babylon Zoos, and we are ostensibly better than you." Turns out we weren't.
I mean, they also had the Ting Tings from that iPod advert. That was their debut. Shut Up and Let Me Go.
I mean, the obvious kind of answer is that you're going to be able to license a debut a great deal cheaper. You know, initially...
Going back to the earlier...
Initially, no one was, you know... Because people weren't really using, like, actual old music in ads until the mid-80s, it probably didn't actually cost Levi's terribly much to use. I heard it through the grapevine or... Rupert Tee isn't Levi's, but yeah.
No, you're right, it isn't,
But it wouldn't actually have cost that much. And then obviously record companies wised up and it's kind of like, no, it will actually cost you a great deal of money to use, you know, any of these old ads. So at which point it's like, okay, we can't, you know, no grunge act worth its salt will sell out to us. But what if we discovered the grunge act Stiltskin in the wilds of Scotland and put their debut on a jeans ad?
Yeah. What if we can give them a song, or say, we can get your song on a jeans ad if you write a song which is like this? I mean, there was no idea that Babylon Zoo, that Spaceman, was an actual band. It didn't make any sense to me that this was a band. And then I heard their records, and it still made no sense to me that they were a band. And then I heard their second album, and it now makes sense.
It has to be said that if we do ever do the follow-up singles poll, then all the money's gone by Babylon Zoo.
I've never heard. To introduce it. Yeah, I have.
What does it sound like?
I mean, it's not very good. It's a little bit plodding, but you know, it's. I mean, what do you do in those situations? Again, it's like this hypersaturated media situation where I think the other thing about having debut bands or unknowns in your adverts is they come with zero baggage. So, you know, Marvin Gaye, like it or not, turns up with a fair bit of baggage, not least being murdered by his dad and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, if you're trying to have a clean slate for your wonderful new product, or certainly Apple iPod adverts were all about doing this, it was either that or go for U2 and then we'll dump an entire U2 album on your iPod and that will go well.
Because the other iPod artist was Feist, who was in the poll. Though not with the iPod song.
No. And not with her debut, but she wasn't well known, so yeah.
No, but I think that that's probably... An example of an artist whose career wasn't terribly well served by doing those adverts, because it just kind of pigeonholed her as doing a particular thing. That was quite annoying because you heard it 1,000 times on an advert.
Although I did enjoy the Sesame Street remix of that 1, 2, 3, 4 song where she was like actually using it for educational purposes. So well done, Feist.
Yeah, it's a counting song and she made it count. There is that bit where you do get the other bit, which is sort of the crate delving stuff, where the adverts go through someone's material, find something which is completely unlike everything else, and it becomes a hit. It becomes a debut hit, but obviously we haven't seen them in these polls because a lot of the times they've had loads and loads and loads of previous songs. I mean, we didn't have Pulp's song, for example, in Pulp's debut in this because it was 10 years before and frankly terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, that would have been a kind of litmus test of, you know, even more so than Catatonia.
I also found that with a lot of dance records, I was trying to find look up dance and techno acts to nominate for the poll, and it always seemed to be like, oh, this debut just isn't actually very good. It's just my first Ableton mix. And I just decided to put it out randomly as, you know, a white label. And it's...
Well, there's no need, is there? There's no need to make a debut that changes the world, because all you're trying to do is get DJs to buy your white labels. Then if suddenly you come across a great idea, like, you know, say the Prodigy, four or three songs in, suddenly go, okay, if I do a bit more like this, sample a bit more, you know, a name sample, and then you've got a career off the back of it. So I think, you know, again, it's what are the records for, and it wasn't necessarily that the record was for making your name at that point. It was just so that people might buy you and then be better down the line.
I mean, the question is there a gatekeeper that cares about debut singles somewhere in your industry? Because obviously, if you're a...
Well, I think his name is Tom Ewing, and I believe he's appearing on this podcast.
Well, apart from caring about them in the sense of, can I do a ridiculous Twitter poll about them? But like, you know, if you were a punk band, the chance of John Peel playing your first single would be appreciably higher than the chance of John Peel playing your second single, because the first single had a kind of, look, I have discovered this band cachet, which Peel enjoyed. And that kind of like filtered into the music and eventually became, you know, a sort of industry or part of indie music in the 90s to a degree, which eventually I think the end of the debut single, not in the poll, but is surely To Earth With Love by Gay Dad. The moment at which... in which the debut single bubble burst was when people actually heard Gay Dad.
I think they were warmed up by Menswear and Symposium, though. I mean, I think at that point we realised that diminishing returns had diminished to such a degree that just having something new that no one had heard, there's a reason why no one had heard it or no one wanted to hear it. So
I enjoyed the Gay Dad single. I thought it was good. I could still hum it.
I mean, is there a thing about debut singles having to be a manifesto, having to be something new?
I think if you're John Lydon, then yes. Like, it'll have to be so... Well, actually, if you've got baggage of a previous band, especially if it...
That's really interesting.
Yeah, like, you need to break free. I mean, there's loads of examples of this, like Peter Gabriel or Lauryn Hill just wanting to completely escape anything that the Fugees did. She wanted nothing to do with them. She didn't want Wyclef like producing a track. She's like, I'm going to do this all myself. Because why would you, if you've got all these ideas and you why are you going to like give that song to a band that you're having disagreements with or like that you can't bear to see that be in the same room as anymore? Like you just want to go out there, do it yourself, and like express yourself and say like I can do it on my own. I think the best example of this is Jerry Halliwell, who is not content with being one of the most eyeballed women on the planet, decided she needed more attention and released a song called Look At Me.
Yes. Yeah.
And Robbie Williams doing Freedom as well has a similar kind of... Yeah, were you that trapped in Take That, Robbie? Was it that bad?
I'm just going back mentally to Frank Sinatra, who, in my mind, did completely the opposite of that, which was that he said, oh, right, I'm not sure if I'll be able to sort of break out too much. I know, but Cole Porter, he's really good at writing songs. Shall I pick the biggest hit song from Cole Porter, this big hit songwriter, and just do a fairly straight down the line, unexceptional version of that? Yes, this is how I will make my mark as a solo artist.
That is interesting, but are there any other debuts that are too obvious? That are too kind of like...
Is Freddie Mercury's one The Great Pretender? Or is that down the line? I think it is The Great Pretender, so that is a little bit on the nose for Freddie at that point in time.
What about Rachel Stevens doing a Britney knockoff? Like, I think Sweet Dreams of My LAX was originally like given to Britney, and Britney was like, nah. I was like, oh, Rachel, I'll have it.
And of course, the S Club 7 had LA 7, didn't they, as a show? So, I mean, there's a coded gag in there.
I recognise it's made sort of the final 32, but, you know, Natalie Imbruglia's Torn, which is a cover of something. I suppose there's something about just tapping material that's already been used.
Norwegian hitmaker's Edna Swap.
Ah, and weren't they cross?
The other thing here is when the material won't fit with the band you're in. So obviously Phil Collins' I Just Got My Wife Just Left Me album was never going to be a Genesis thing. You know, it became a Phil Collins, you know, it became what it was.
Their wives have not having left them yet.
Well, yes, indeed, or on the way. That's for the second album. And yeah, similarly, Peter Gabriel was obviously, basically leaving Genesis gives you an impetus to write a quite good debut single, it seems.
I feel like, to be fair. Just going back to Rachel Stevens, I feel like there are quite a lot of songs which claim to have been offered to Britney. If you look around in Wikipedia, and it might be like my mates used to send their demo tapes to Brian Eno, offered to Britney.
Yeah, I mean, is there, if you're in a band like S Club or Girls Aloud or Spice Girls, obviously there's five of you. When the band splits up, you're all going to angle at having a solo career. Is there a playbook here? What do you do? Do you do the most? Is it best to be the first out the traps? Is there an idea there's a pecking order that some people are more popular than others?
The idea is not to be the Nadine and release your solo career through Tesco only. I'd avoid that if possible. Like maybe the Nicola Roberts, she went down the trendy route, didn't she?
I think
because with Nicola Roberts, I think she was probably the member of Girls Aloud for whom like maybe least was expected, so that actually gave her a little bit more freedom to do something that was actually quite interesting and good. Same with actually Siobhan from the Sugar Babes, whose solo albums are great, not in the poll, but
this is a genuine question. Have any of the other Spice Girls other than Jerry had a good or artistically interesting solo career?
All of them did.
Not counting marrying David Beckham.
Well, every single Spice Girl had a good solo single, and that is a hill I will die on.
What's Mel B's?
Her cover of Word Up by Cameo.
Oh, okay. That's the only one.
That's a stretch.
It is a stretch, but I watched it on Top of the Pops, and it definitely instilled a reaction in me, which I think is the mark of a good pop music.
And I guess following on from that, does there have to be one of the group who sort of takes the dive first and is the first one to record a solo debut single, and then sort of they attract the, this is the post them being in a famous group.
Criticism. If someone leaves.
And then when the rest of them do it.
Yeah, if someone leaves, then that's Jerry's situation. She left to have a solo career. Robbie did that as well.
And Robbie, yes.
Whereas a lot of the other ones, it's with say Westlife, Boyzone, everyone just assumed it'd be Ronan Keating, and yeah, he's the one who had a career. With Take That, they bobbled around, and we are fond of Mark Owen's solo career, but you know most people won't think of the solo stuff as being that great, and it's only really Gary and Mark and Robbie that succeeded in that one.
So, yeah, the Gorillaz of the 80s, Jive Funny.
Yes.
Come on, they're not that bad. Jive Bunny, yes. So I'm very interested in Jive Bunny. And it is, yes. And,
really?
And in fact, the reflection of rave culture, which was happening in the UK at the time, the peak of Acid House. And Jive Bunny and the Master Mix is... emission of a succession of repetitive beats was actually very reflective of the collective euphoria and delusion experienced by the UK at the time. So I think it's a really interesting cultural artefact that requires further analysis. But again, like I say, probably not in this podcast.
But is it any good as a record?
I think it is good as a record. I think the medley format, proven by Styles and 45, but crucially this time, not using sound-alike recordings of, like, you know, someone else doing the Archies or whatever. It was actual, you know, actual Glenn Miller sample, because it's all copyright free. Just only taking like 20 seconds, you know, you don't need much more than that. And sellotaping it together with a very pulsing, repetitive beat that's, you know, like I say, like good for dance routines if you're in, like, just so happen to be doing like a primary school dance lesson and you need something that's, you know, not going to stop and start to confuse the kids or anything like that. And sort of like tie it up with this, you know, these images of technological progress and optimism and retrofuturism. And I just think it's an amazing package altogether, and like figureheaded by an anthropomorphic rabbit who's staring dead-eyed into our souls.
It's a debut record that's made of other very old records which aren't debuts in themselves.
One of the interesting things about Jive Bunny, as a commenter pointed out, is that almost any argument you can make about what makes a debut single good. So, like, oh, you know, they came out, they started with a bang, and this was as good as they got, which is something some people say of some of the records, or, you know, oh, this is like a manifesto for what they were going to do. These all apply to Swing the Mood by Jive Bunny. So it's a sort of, you know, test for how far are you likely to take these.
Yeah, I mean, even the diminishing returns of like many pop acts like also applies. Like Jive Bunny's follow-up single, That's What I Like, introducing Jive Bunny's girlfriend. Definitely not the best step that Jive Bunny could have taken, but I don't know. This it just really fascinates me, and all the haters like who. Just like, oh gosh, this is just the, you know, the worst piece of, you know, like a derivative, or it's just, you know, lacks creative value or anything. It's almost like they're jealous that this was so successful with so little effort. And it's like, well, why, you know, just because it's easy to do doesn't mean it's any less impactful or enjoyable.
I mean, we had a brief conversation about the whole Mars bomb the base, and then there's this little smattering of these, which I think pinnacles at S Express, but nevertheless, I think there you've got quite a lot of creativity going on as well. I think there's plenty in Swing the Moon as well.
Well, and can I just also challenge the idea that it's easy to do, or easier to do, in that, you know, constructing something that feels like a single unified track and that is pleasing to listen to and you know, builds and resolves and is fun, even if it's not your own recording, that it's still, you know, there's skill involved there.
I mean, particularly if it's as it's full of music that like none of your primary school audience listens to or is familiar, you know, the stuff in, because one of the things that like alienated me from it, even as a 16 year old in 1989, so the prime Bunny hating age, one of the things was it was all this old music. Which now, of course, it sounds actually quite a bit better to me, because the stuff in it is all stuff that I like. I mean, okay, it's being kind of cruelly mistreated by a cartoon rabbit, but it's
who among like, us hasn't been?
Yeah, you know, them's the breaks. But I think at the time I was really angry that there was this kind of old stuff in the charts instead of exciting new stuff, which ought to be in the charts, like the Stone Roses. His terrible debut single. They're an indie band that made an awful debut single years before they became famous, so we were spared them.
I know, if only they could have just like taken a few tips from Jive Bunny, they would have been laughing. Just like sellotape the best 20 seconds of all their songs together and go for that. Why not?
Isn't there a Stone Roses mega mix that somebody did?
Yes, there is. There is, yeah, there was.
In like 1990.
Okay, well done then.
There we are. So they did indeed. They weren't too proud to...
Well, I'm not sure whether they sanctioned it or not. because remember, they were on Silvertone Records at that point. Silvertone were milking them for all they were worth, so
It
probably wasn't legally sanctioned.
What debut single should we talk about next?
Sugar Babes. I think we touched on Sugar Babes earlier. While I like Overload, I think it's another example of where the band really don't seem ready, or by the time they've released the single, you know, like they've gone past it. Because in that video that they filmed for it, they look just so nervous. Obviously, they're like uncomfortable teenagers, but they're awkward and gangly. And while I think that's part of its charm, it's so frustrating, because you know sort of like what they could, you know, their potential, but it's just not quite there yet. Whereas like some of the other ones, like in the poll, like the Charlotte Hatherley one, I was really surprised on that. I thought I was kind of going into expecting to hear something like Ash, because that's kind of all I knew from their output. But it was actually quite sort of gangly and interesting, and that awkwardness is actually to her advantage. I really sort of like found myself quite intrigued and wanted to hear more. So well done, Charlotte.
Yeah, yeah.
That comes out of that idea of there being sort of someone who. So she joined Ash on their second album because they needed an extra guitarist live, but also that meant that, so it's a bit like the whole the Breeders situation and so on, where you've got a talented musician but who is basically not allowed to write the songs for the band, or that's not what the band does. So when she finally leaves, she has got probably 5 to 6 years worth of material that she's dying to get out there. But it was a really good track.
One thing that has struck me, like, we're now into the in the actual poll, we're now into the final groups, and I ran the poll chronologically, and every decade and every era has been represented in the final groups, apart actually the 50s. unfortunately,
justice for Frosini,
and in fact the 50s has got a bum deal from it as well, but there was an entire day devoted to the 2010s, and none of it managed to get through. And is it that the music of the 2010s is rubbish, or that it's it's too soon to know what makes a good debut, or has debutness changed in some way?
What, I mean, certainly the record industry has changed in terms of what it's willing to invest in. If you've got if you're a record label, you're much less likely to hang on to an act and keep them back for a year while they mature and then they're ready to release a big hit or get the right song for them. Like, say for example, like if you're Britney or Kesha or a big pop ingenue like that, then you would have been worth the investment, because you know you're going to make it back in sort of album sales and tours and all of that. Now, who knows what's gonna happen with your brand new artist? You've got to have your bankers like Adele or Ed Sheeran, and everyone else is like, well, good luck. You know, if you can have one single, you better have like either earned it already, got all your hype and all your socials, all your numbers sorted already. Otherwise, we're not going to bother investing in any of this. Maybe you're not even in a proper video, you're just going to get one of those crappy lyric only ones.
But also that means you're probably breaking outside of the system. So where we had stuff with Grime or say Katie B, who are doing mixtapes, there's stuff sort of floating around, which means A, your debut may not be that good because you've just been engaging with Spotify or YouTube from day one, and then again, say if you get picked up, then it's either a massive makeover and a new name and Lana Del Rey go via another route, but then your debuts are probably not going to be great because it's already out there.
Yeah, actually, like Katy Perry's an interesting one, because she was a songwriter for quite a few years before she released I Kissed a Girl, and she was like living in the UK and like writing songs for.
So was Gaga.
And so they kind of like proved themselves that in a slightly different direction, rather than just sort of like hanging around on Mickey Mouse Club set or practicing backflips. They're actually earning their keep, literally.
But like, I think what Pete was saying as well is that the whole sort of start of your career is incredibly fuzzy now as an artist, because you're going to have you know, like one person that I looked into was Charlie XCX, and she has kind of four or five different things that could have been her debut, none of which are actually very good. And then she starts releasing the stuff that people actually like her for. So, but this is, you know, it, unlike the metal bands that I was talking about, where there's one or two singles that are definitely them, and it's definitely, you know, Motorhead put out this single and it's just a bad single on some minor label. This is kind of stuff where, was it released? Was it not? It kind of, maybe it got leaked to a music blog. Maybe it was on YouTube. Maybe it was on SoundCloud. Maybe it was on a mixtape. All these sort of different...
MySpace.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, MySpace, you know, we had some, you know, MySpace hypes. Lily Allen and the Arctic Monkeys did quite well in the poll for a while. They're now both.
I mean, it launched out. Grimes.
Yeah.
MySpace.
It's actually got her name.
Is it?
Yeah.
It is, it is. The question was, what are your favourite kinds of music? And there were three spaces for it, and she put grime in each of them.
Oh.
Grime. Grimes.
Well, good for her. Like, she picked well. It's good genre.
I don't think she actually knew what grime was at the time, is the end of that story, I believe.
Oh, God, did she...
In what is possibly a nod to her future decision-making, who can say?
Do you think she actually meant Jedward, John and Edward Grimes?
Oh yeah, that is their name, isn't it?
So, yeah.
Of the songs left, what do people feel? How do people feel? Have they got any favourites?
Well, I think Britney's in with a shout, isn't she? Like, it is. It's still a banger. I mean, like, I know we've all heard it a million times, but if you've never like held your pen in your hands and just gone flicky 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 flicky, it's like, come on, clock ticking. Where's my pop single? Yeah.
Yes.
Banger.
I mean, I've got a soft spot, and I've got a soft spot for Buffalo Stance by Nelly Cherry, which I think is going to do well. Even though I hate the bit in the middle where she goes, "I know what you mean." I don't know why that bit really winds me up. Yeah,
she now
that bit I hate.
What is she like?
Yeah.
I'm just astonished that Doo-Wop, That Thing, was Lauryn Hill's debut. It's so good.
Yeah,
it feels like it's really unfair that it was her first solo one.
Just gonna say that if you get rid of Wyclef Jean,
that's my pick for the finale.
Boot out Wyclef and the other one, and
and
suddenly
you're singing.
You know, Praz, the lost Fuji, we'll be encountering Wyclef Jean again next month, of course, in the 2001 poll. With the most romantic song ever made, Perfect Gentleman. Which, anyway, that's going to be a great poll. However, that's for another podcast. One of the things that the Naina Cherry single, which I also think is going to do pretty well, does is, you know, of course, how right at the start of this podcast we were talking about introducing yourself on a single, and Naina Cherry goes one better and introduces some drum sounds. Yes. On the 12-inch, where she says, introducing the hi-hat. And there, so it's a music lesson as well as a banger.
And she introduces another band to then go on to have a number one or a number two. So, you know, she introduces Bomb the Bass on it. So, yeah, you know, she's very open in that way and very giving to her collaborators.
Well, just like Latibra, who, like, in their debut, they name every other person in, like, feminist history apart from themselves, which I think is very generous.
Yeah. It's, yeah, no, you can learn a lot from that single.
Yeah, and, you know, just having that idea. So, obviously, Bjork's debut single isn't called Debut, though. That was a mistake, but it was from the album, Debut. So she came out the traps knowing exactly what she was going to say there. So, and she's still in the moment.
Now,
I have to say
that I thought that the Icelandic version of Birthday by the Sugar Cubes, which, as well as being very good, I thought that was maybe in with a shout of being the first non-Anglophone song to get into the last 32, but it hasn't.
But then you mucked that up, Tom, by calling the band yeah, the Icelandic version of the word Sugar Cubes.
Yes.
So people didn't realise what it was. It goes to show that people don't necessarily listen to the records, which
yes,
we kind of
the
know,
dark secret
sadly.
Of the polls. Yeah. That was actually quite funny, though. The horror when people realised they'd been voting for the rubbish Jesus and Mary Chain single over Birthday by the Sugar Cubes, because they did not, their knowledge of Icelandic was so paltry that they did not know that Sukkur Molanir meant sugar cubes. But yeah, no, so the Sugar Cubes didn't get into the Last 32, nor did Baby Metal, who were the last J-pop survivor.
I mean, J-pop of sorts. Yeah. J-metal. Yeah,
well, no, because they came metal. Up. My understanding, obviously I'm not an expert in the slightest on J-pop, but my understanding is that they came through the idol system, like every other or most other J-pop acts. And it just happens that what they do is make metal, baby metal, rather than... Is there anything that you think, what the hell is that still doing there? Perhaps Form the Band is...
Form the Band, yes. Yeah, that would be, that's the one I would say, why is that still there? But I know lots of people are fond of it.
Yes, and it did have very easy groups.
Yeah,
that's very generous, Tom.
Yes, well, you know, it dominated those very easy groups as a mark of its quality, but the groups were indeed pretty easy.
I don't know, I think Ceremony is past its, like, peak. Yeah, like, it's not a good version. I mean, I like Joy Division, I'm so on New Order. Like, the first recording of Ceremony is not good. Like, they did it better the second time. So I think that's had its run, and I think it can be safely taken outside and dealt with.
Yeah, oh, but I would say the same about Radio Free Europe, that the first recording of that, which is the one that people are in theory voting on, is a very much the runt of the Radio Free Europe litter.
But I don't think people are actually...
Yeah, I don't think people are actually voting for that.
Yeah, they're voting for that, the version they know in their head. So, yeah, you know, fair enough. That's how these things work. And,
yeah.
You know, people will come back and do that, I guess. I mean, yeah, I would vote for the four-track demo version of Dress over the original version of Dress by PJ Harvey.
PJ Harvey's Dress, yeah.
Yeah, but they're both fantastic, and I'm glad that that's got this far. I don't think it's got much left in it, but it's a dark horse.
One tactical thing is that if Killing in the Name goes any further, it will almost certainly be banned from the Christmas poll.
Yes.
Oh,
even the version with sleigh bells on.
Is there any the version with sleigh bells on? Is why? Is I Want to Be Your Dog by the Stooges? Yes.
But I Want to Be Your Dog is for life, Tom, not just for Christmas.
Yes. What have your discoveries been in this poll? Anything has leapt out to you?
Oh, the accordion track, obviously. It's never off my phone now. It's all I listen to is Wax Cylinders of accordion music.
The Frassini revival.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it your ringtone? Because it's quite a long one. Many people don't realise how much sort of a Wax Cylinder could actually take. They think it's quite short, but no, that's more than 4 minutes.
I think I'd stick with Charlotte Hadley. I think expectations versus reality is like definitely really good ratio on that. So yeah, good on her.
I mean, the Amendola 2 track. Yeah, I mean, I think I had heard it before, but thinking of it as a debut was great. It's just been nice to sort of revisit some of these things as well and say the ones where people come out of the traps with what they do, like the Ramones, sort of the tracks which start to define a genre like Rapper's Delight and stuff like that, which are great. It's good to see them here, you know. And I mean, discoveries above and beyond that, not so sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously it was lots of fun looking through Wax Cylinder recordings to try to find one that I thought stood up. But I think for me, the discovery has been again Lauryn Hill's debut, which is just really like angering in how great it is. Like the feeling that it inspires is like resentment.
Yeah. Bitterness.
But in a constructive way. good on you, Lauren.
I would say, and in fact I just voted it for it in the Best Discovery poll, The Crusher by the Novas. With the caveat that I would be astonished if any other single by the Novas ever existed, except for The Crusher, which is basically a singer pretending to be a wrestler. And yelling, "Do the hammer lock your turkey necks," that's the audience.
That was a good one. I enjoyed "Do the Hammer Lock."
So yeah, so much like Pump Up the Volume, but somehow less celebrated. I expect that it's a debut and also a final single. So on that note, we shall wind it up. That has been the debut singles podcast, not the debut podcast. It's the third episode. And next month, we will be talking about the year 2001, which was nominated by the person who nominated the winner of the 1990 poll, George Michael, who, of course, we did not talk about at all in the 1990 podcast. So we will see if we can keep up that proud record by focusing only on the Flotsam and Jetsam of 2001 and not mentioning the eventual winner at all. But I'll be joined by three guests, who they are, I don't know. And you're going to have to edit some of that rubbish out, I think, Pete. Anyway, that was debut singles 2001 next month. Thank you very much to Kat, Kerry and Pete for joining me on it, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.